29 minutes now before 9 o'clock on the Dove, and one guest leaves, another comes in. And Patrick Doyle, of course, you know Patrick. He's here every Tuesday now on a regular basis, and then we pull him in whenever it is. We need triage counseling. That's kind of what, it's like the MASH unit, you know. Good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Okay. I'm not sure why I sound like I'm in a barrel, but there we go. Good. Happy Tuesday to you. What have you been thinking about lately?
Well, you don't want to know.
Really? I don't know. It is a frightening place to go, the mind of Patrick Doyle. Yeah. But we do venture into it every Tuesday.
Into enter at your own risk.
Oh, that's true.
Uh-huh. No, actually, today I wanted to talk about addiction.
And what kind?
Well, that's a good question, because I have I don't think addiction is specific to substance. And, you know, I like to talk about this subject every once in a while because it's so prevalent. And there's so many people struggling with it on so many various levels. When we think of addiction, we tend to think of the guy who's really like his life is all messed up and he doesn't have anywhere to go and he's, you know, all strung out.
Yeah.
But addiction, did you know that 95% of all addicts are only five, let me put it this way, only 5% of addicts are skid row.
Really?
The vast majority of other addicts are in the boardroom, are at work. The other 95% are generally functional people.
Yeah, well,
they work.
And we hear the celebrities who all of a sudden you find out they've had a problem for a long time, but they're putting out albums, they're starring in movies and all that.
Yeah. So, and the other thing that I really believe is that addiction is not about just drugs, alcohol, gambling, or porn. Addiction, and let me give you my definition. I believe that addiction is really about a compulsion. Okay, compulsion. When you have a compulsion to do something, you can't seem to stop. Compulsion, in my mind, is always the result of a lack of peace. Okay, if I have peace in my heart, if I can live within my own skin, I don't have to go alter. I don't have to go change how I feel. Okay, addiction or compulsion is all about changing how I feel. Why are people alcoholics? Because alcohol is a very effective mood alterer. When I feel sad or down or bummed out, hey, having a drink or two makes me feel a lot better.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It works. That's why people do it. No one ever picked up a drink and said, here's to destroying my life.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen that way. If you drank today and tomorrow were in the gutter, you'd stop. The problem is this process is very insidiously slow. You don't really notice. Now, there are a lot of other substances or things you can be addicted to where people might not, you know, recognize it as addiction. Like, for example, I think you can be addicted to food. Now, can you stop eating food? No.
Right.
You got to eat food, but you can still be addicted to it. You can be addicted to gambling. You can be addicted to religion, being good. You can be addicted to work. You can be addicted to relationships. You could be addicted to sex. You could be addicted to, you know.
You name it.
You name it. Exactly. Because when you take it outside of the realm of addiction, you put it into the realm of compulsion. People are compulsive about a lot of things. TV. Okay. I know I'm going to be treading on thin ice here, but video games.
Really? Is that possible?
As I'm raising my hand. And
it shows it also can fit in any age group, too. It's not the stereotypical image, perhaps.
That's right. Yeah. And people across, you know, the spectrum are affected by these things. Now, here's the deal. When somebody's addicted or somebody is out of control with something, compulsively out of control, what do you do? How do you handle it? And I know there are many people listening right now who know loved ones who they're thinking of right now. They know, oh yeah, I know that guy, or my husband, or my son, or my daughter, or my wife, or you know, my uncle, or my friend. Mm-hmm. We all know somebody who's struggling, and you know, there's a lot of people within the church, particularly, that are struggling secretly. No one knows, and you may be listening and hearing this and going, you know what? I know that I struggle with that thing. I can't seem to stop. You know, continuing to involve myself in that, you know, shopping. There's lots of things can happen. So I want you to, as you're listening, think about what it is that that you might be struggling with. Is it possible that you have a compulsive problem, that you're doing something to cope with the stress or the pain that you have inside that isn't necessarily from a social point of view unhealthy, but you know that you're doing it in an unhealthy way? So here's an example. I know a guy who was an alcoholic, destroyed his whole family, lost his whole family, was down to nothing. And then he got sober. And he started working, and he became a workaholic.
Oh, just transferred it.
Yeah,
huh?
And then he got another family, and his business became very successful. He became wealthy, and he worked. He was a workaholic, and he lost his second family because he was a workaholic.
Wow. But that one would seem to be more socially acceptable.
It was
than another one.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So when he was at the end of his addiction from working, he was a wealthy, well-respected guy.
Still paid off, right?
Still alone.
Wow.
Still separated from the people that he loved. Still no intimate relationships that were of any value. So, again, from a societal perspective, we could say, oh, see, that's better. Well, until you've lived in the shoes of somebody who's completely isolated, feels horrible about themselves, you know, somebody who's wealthy and feels horrible about themselves, all they do is have more opportunity to destroy themselves. Mm. Somebody who doesn't have anything, they're just limited to what they can do to hurt themselves. So there's no, to me, that's just as bad as somebody who, say, is strung out and living on the street. There's no real difference on the inside. And this is the thing I want to get to, because addiction is a symptom of the real problem. The real problem here is that I don't have any peace. Why is that? What is disrupting my peace? What is destroying my ability to be inside my own skin and be okay with it? And what is the remedy?
You know, what I see happening also is that churches, while they're supposed to be spiritual hospitals, end up being the type of thing where, well, because I am a member, I can't show that I have a vulnerability, because the expectations are I'm supposed to have gotten beyond that. So you can see where people in churches perhaps are the last ones to look for that health.
That's
help, as opposed to somebody like you're saying, the Skid Row bums, who knows where the Salvation Army is, and I got to go there. I need help.
But do you know how many elders and pastors I have treated over the years?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And you know, because what I do is confidential, they have the freedom to come in and share. But
otherwise, what are their options?
Exactly.
They're
kind of stranded, and it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure to be the guy up front. It's a lot of pressure to be the guy who's supposed to know all the answers, although that's not true. And particularly because most leaders live outside of intimate fellowship with other believers where there's true and in-depth honesty, that creates a fertile soil for strong compulsive behavior. So, I think Ted Haggard is a good example. So here he is, acting out in a sexual way. I believe he had a sexual addiction, and I also believe that he had a drug addiction based on what we've heard. He was using meth, and he was with a prostitute, a male prostitute. Okay, how do you get to that place? If a guy's up on Sunday morning preaching the scriptures, and he's a very successful preacher, he's in charge of the family, Coalition of America, whatever, I don't even know the name of it. How do you maintain those two realities? How do you go from church to, being with a prostitute and smoking crack?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you do that?
And how do you mentally even work through that? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, here's what we think. This with addiction, one of the main things that we have with addiction is denial. Okay? People in an addictive lifestyle have to be proficient at denial, because you can't do what, say, Ted was doing and be in the reality of what's happening. You have to deny it. I've been in, many situations with addicts and I've seen profound denial. One of my favorite stories, though, is I was teaching a DUI class. All the people in the class had received DUIs, and so they have to go to treatment. And so we were providing them with a DUI class, and so there's about, I think 10 or 11 people in the class. And so all of a sudden, the last guy comes in, and suddenly the room smells like alcohol.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, well, you're not supposed to drink when you're on DUI treatment. It's kind of like bench probation. It's the judge's order. You can't drink. And
right.
And so, you know, that's against the rules. That's to mention it's not very wise.
And everybody else is noticing it, I'm sure, in the room,
yeah,
too, right?
Exactly. You don't come to DUI group drunk. That's not usually a good thing. So anyway, I was like, So I said, hey, smells like somebody's been drinking. I didn't say who. I just said, smells like somebody's been drinking. Everybody's like, oh, not me, huh?
Everybody.
You know, and so I said, well.
Oh, then it must have been me.
I said, well, I'll go get the breathalyzer and we'll find out.
Oh, really?
Whoa. Yeah. So everybody sits down and I go around the room and I made sure the guy that came in that smelled like alcohol, I made sure he was last.
I see.
You know, a little bit of torture on my part, but.
I guess. So sweating profusely.
Yeah, we go around 0000000. We get to him and he starts blowing in and I click the button and. Man, the numbers start climbing. He was like at a, I think it was a 0.14. So he's just under double the legal limit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I looked at the thing and I said, so, looks like you've been drinking. And he's looking me dead in the eye and he says, I've not been drinking. I don't know what you're talking about. And he's slurring his words and he smells like a brewery. And I'm like, well, but the machine here says you're a 0.14. And he's like, no, I don't know what is, the machine must be something wrong with it, but I have not been drinking. I had some mouthwash this morning, but that's about it. I'm like, wait, would you drink four bottles or something?
Yeah.
So it was it's profound. And then the people in the room were all like, you got to be kidding me. And, you know, they've all done it too before, but it was a great lesson for them to see, oh, that's denial in action.
Yeah.
You can have reality right in front of you, and you can manipulate that in your own mind to completely not see it. Okay, if you can do that, that puts you at great risk for continuing your addiction. So there's a lot of people out there that have behavior that needs to be confronted. But I'm telling you, folks, when you confront somebody, and I've never confronted somebody in addiction or in denial, I should say more specifically, and had them go, oh, gee, thanks. I appreciate that.
Oh.
Usually they go, shut up. Leave me alone.
You've caught me. Yeah.
No. Get away from me. I'm not guilty. You know, I'm not. There's nothing wrong with me. And so. You have to understand that denial is a part of the process, and confrontation is a part of breaking denial. It's not something that goes away. You have to consistently be confronting that behavior. And over the long haul, eventually that person may or may not come around. But don't be under the assumption that if you tell somebody in denial the truth, they're going to thank you. In fact, you should expect they're probably going to be irritated with you. Okay, just know that. So those of you out there in families where you have an addict in your family and you're trying to talk to them about it, don't expect them to be nice about it. They're going to be upset. They're going to be manipulative. That's how they survive. And I want you to understand this. Underneath every addict is a deeply wounded person. Okay? Addicts can be very mean and nasty and manipulative and lie and steal and cheat. That's all very real. And there's a matter of degrees to that, you know. Somebody can be mildly manipulative or somebody can be extremely manipulative. But somebody who's involved in a compulsive problem is going to be manipulative on some level. So what I've found with addicts is everyone I've ever dealt with underneath the addiction is somebody who's deeply wounded. Now, that gets me back to the issue of peace. Why is it that the person can't be good inside their own skin? Why is it that they got to go alter themselves? They got to go change how they feel? Well, it's because things have happened to them that are painful, and they don't know how to cope with it. And initially, when they started doing their compulsion, whatever that was, gambling, sex, shopping, drugs, you know, whatever, when they started doing that compulsion, it gave them a moniker of relief. It gave them some relief. And so they thought, okay, finally, something that helps a little bit. Hmm. And when it helps a little bit, if a little's good, then a lot's better, right? Well, not necessarily. So because I never addressed the problem, I just found something that made me feel better about feeling bad. Mm-hmm. Then I'm naturally set up to be in this cycle of it getting worse and worse and worse because I'm not really addressing the problem. So here's one of the things that AA, I think, has been brilliant at. And I think this is one of the things that is why AA is so successful. You know, in the first four steps of AA, you have to admit there's a problem. You have to agree that God's the only one that can help you. You have to turn your will over to Him, to God. And you have to make a list of a searching, fearless moral inventory. You have to look at yourself and see, what have I done? What have I done to cause damage? You have to begin to deal with the things that you've been running from. And you do it in an environment in AA that's accepting, that's not judgmental. They keep accepting, they work with you, they understand you, they don't condemn you. And so that's why it's so successful. And then they're totally anonymous. They don't make you tell anyone. So it gives you the ability to do this in a way that isn't going to throttle your whole life. You know, so if a guy goes to his boss and says, I'm an alcoholic, he could lose his job. No. Or he could go to AA, and I know that there's people in the church have a lot of heartburn with AA, and there's a lot of debate and all that, but I have seen AA be extraordinarily helpful to people, particularly people who may not be Christian. They might be sort of kind of maybe Christian. Not that that can really be the case, but
right.
They have some history with Christianity or whatever. AA is really a safe place for them to go. And I've seen many, many people come to the Lord through that process. But somebody who's actively in their compulsive problem or their addiction is not generally going to just jump into the church.
Yeah.
They're going to generally be interested in moving away from it.
Well, I was going to ask you about the accountability groups in general, as well as interventions, too. You know, I'm even seeing there's a reality TV show now dealing with interventions.
I've seen that. Yeah.
And, okay, you look at that and you think, I don't know, is this the best environment to have cameras rolling for what otherwise would be a serious intervention? But that aside, it shows that there is that point where friends say something more has to be done.
Exactly.
Are they really effective, our interventions?
Yeah, I've done many interventions in my career.
Yeah.
And, yes, I found them to be highly successful. And here's what happens. You have to redefine success, because people think that interventions, only success is when the person goes to treatment and gets sober. I don't believe that. I think that for a family who's got an addict in it, and the addict is wreaking havoc on the family saying, look, if you don't get help, we're going to cut you off, is highly effective for the family members who aren't involved in the addiction. So they don't have to keep being drugged through the knothole, because an addict doesn't care. They're in survival mode. The rest of the people have, you know, trying to live normal lives, trying to like keep their act together, trying to like be emotionally stable. Well, the addict doesn't care. They're completely spun out on whatever. So when a family sort of lays down the law and says, look, or a group of people who love someone, look, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to help you destroy yourself. We're not going to be involved. We're going to cut the ties. That does two things. One is it spares the family, so that's a success. Number two is it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the addict. And here's the other thing. I've never seen an addict change until the pain got great enough.
Hmm. And does an intervention do that then?
The intervention is a way to ratchet up the pain. Because now a lot of the support is going to be withdrawn. And what I've seen over and over again is that in a lot of interventions I've done is the person has initially said, no way, I'm out of here.
Right.
Okay? And then the family holds their boundary.
And that's the key.
Exactly.
You can't have anyone cave in.
That's
right?
The key. You got to hold the boundary. And here's the other thing, that if you're going to do an intervention, you cannot set up boundaries that you cannot hold. That is setting yourself up for failure. You must be able to hold the boundary. So when I've done family, when I've educated and been involved in helping families prepare for the intervention and lead them through it, one of my first questions is, what can you actually do? Don't tell me what you want to do. If you cannot follow through with it, then we can't say it. So we have to be very clear. And so then what it does is it forces the family then to really look at themselves and say, okay, what can I do? What honestly can I do? Instead of having a grandiose idea, well, I'm not going to ever, and I'm going to, you know, and then the person comes around and you fold. And let me tell you, you know, having two addicts, siblings, and having had two addicts that were parents, you know, I know something about this, and I know how quickly, as strong and as knowledgeable as I can be, if my siblings come around, I can just be as weak as a little puppy dog.
The dynamics change.
It does. And so you have to really be aware of where your weaknesses are, where your strengths are. Otherwise, you could really get yourself in a bad situation. You can make a situation worse by putting down false boundaries that you can't hold. Because all it does is then embolden the addict that, well, you can't ever. Yeah. And they just run you over more. Yeah. So really important when you're dealing with addict to be aware of what you can actually follow through with. That's the key. What can you follow through with? If you say, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, can you pull that off? can you turn the phone off? Can you click their call off? Or are you going to have to pick it up? Mm. I'm not going to give you any more money. Can you follow through with that when they come to you and say, I'm starving to death?
Well, and you know what? You've opened up something I hadn't really thought of before, but I think it begs a question. It almost sounds like the name of a book. Hmm. It seems to me the addicts you're talking about, and maybe most of them are that have gone this extreme, have right. personalities that make them very strong-willed, like the strong-willed addict. Because right. if you have a passive one, it's like, oh, I just feel so bad, and you know, mm-hmm. that's it. Right. But you're talking about somebody who's there to fight. Well, you just soon fight than switch.
Yeah,
right?
Well, here's the thing. Every addict is desperate. So
that would make them almost strong-willed, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That's why you see some of the personality changes you see in people. Because, look, one of the main goals of the addict is to protect supply. Mm. I've got to have it. So you know what? If you're in my way, you become a target. So yesterday you were my ally because you were helping me. Yeah. Today you're saying no? Well, I'm going to run you over because I got to get it. There's no not answering to the call for the addict. If it's calling, I got to get it. And that's why people exchange entire they give up their kids, they give up their wives, their husbands, their businesses, they give up everything. Not intentionally when they look back, but it's like they're in this moment of I got to have it. Yeah.
And you know what, it doesn't even sound like it's drugs, it could be power.
It could be.
Somebody who has a lust for power,
exactly.
You wonder why do they ramrod all these people? Well,
exactly.
Because they've got it. That's their drug.
Right. That's what's making the wow. hole in their heart feel better. So it becomes a matter of survival for them. Now, as we stand back and look at them, we're like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's making more sense.
Yeah.
The more you...
Right.
You're right, though, because we know them in the way we want to see them.
Exactly.
Right?
We're looking at them from a normal framework, and they're like not normal. The way they operate internally is completely centered around one thing. And they obsess about it while they're... doing other things, their mind is consumed with getting and consuming the substance, or getting and being involved so let's take somebody, say, for example, who I just watched a show the other day. I ate 33,000 calories a day. It was about this guy in England who's like 800 pounds.
Whoa.
And
8,300 calories a day?
33,000.
30 what?
Calories a day.
Yeah. How do you even do that?
Well,
they
broke down all the stuff that he ate.
Oh, man.
And it was like, in a day, it was like, wow.
It's eating all the time.
Well, you don't get to 800 pounds by mistake.
Yeah.
Anyway, what he talked about was his addiction to food. He says, you know, I know I shouldn't, but I crave it. I got to have it. You know, to the point where here this guy is, 800 pounds. He can see that he's a little overweight. He can see that he hasn't been out of his apartment in 7 years.
Mm. Wow.
Okay.
Obviously, he has people supplying him, so
yes.
We have enablers all over the place.
Yes, huh? yes. So here's the thing.
Wow.
When we look at that, we think, come on, dude.
Yeah. Get a life.
Yeah. And he's like, I can't. I don't know how. I want to stop, but I can't stop. So there's that compulsive, out of control, altered thinking. This thing is he said food to me is better than sex. And I'm like, okay, that's you've just ratcheted food up to a place it's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, and he doesn't have any friends. He doesn't have any intimate relationships, whether it's physically intimate or otherwise. He's alone. The only relationship he has is food.
Wow.
And so when we try to take a normal perspective and look at that,
it's not relevant.
Yeah,
really,
we don't know how to handle that.
So what do you do with something extreme?
You got to understand what's going on with that guy. He's deeply wounded. For whatever reason, he has some beliefs about himself that are probably very inaccurate. And the food is a symptom. Obviously, now the food for him, just like with many other compulsions, becomes its own problem. Now I've got weight problems. Now I've got heart problems. Now I've got, you know, family problems. Now I've got all kinds of other problems that now can take precedence. But ultimately, you know, let's say I had, you know, five different problems. You know, each of my fingers on my hand is a problem, and I'm an addict. And I lay the addiction over those fingers. Now all those other problems are not going to be ever dealt with till first I get the addiction under control, because the addiction is the thing I do to avoid those things. So until I become sober or abstinent from whatever thing it is, I can't get to those other problems. So sobriety, stopping, getting clean, it becomes the first priority. Then what that does, and here's where AA has been successful, and I think where other programs haven't, is that once I get sober, that's when the work really starts, because I'm feeling worse than ever when I stop using, because all that stuff I've been running from is flying to the surface, and it's driving me insane, and I want to get rid of it, and I'm really strongly wanting another whatever. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if somebody isn't in a place where they're able to begin to start to deal with that stuff, treatment of their addiction is going to probably be minimal or fail at best. So, I realize we're running out of time here. So, if you have an addict in your family, okay, first of all, talk to someone who knows addiction. You need to go get some help understanding what that person's doing, where they're at, what level, how intense their addiction is. You need to get some education. You need to get checked out to see how codependent, how helpful in a negative way you've been, or where you're at. Check yourself out. Because if you're going to help that person, you got to know where you're at first. That's a huge thing. And so if you hate addicts, you're probably not going to be real helpful. Okay, you just got to realize that. Mm-hmm. Or you maybe need to deal with that, you know, resentment. So have yourself checked out. Talk to somebody who knows addiction, and then involve other people who love that person. If they're willing to be involved, great. If they aren't, okay. And encourage that person to talk to someone who is knowledgeable about addiction. I would also encourage you, there's lots of AA meetings in this area. There's a couple of Celebrate Recovery meetings in this area that are Christian. I really encourage you to go check them out. There's Al-Anon meetings in this area, which are Al-Anon meetings are for people who are the spouses or the loved ones of addicts, to help them learn how to deal with the sickness they have acquired by being connected to an addict. So it's important not to stay isolated. Number one rule, you can't stay isolated and deal with this thing. You've got to deal with it by getting involved with other people who know something about it. And this is the hard part, because it's very difficult to get to go and talk to someone and say, you know, I really am suspicious that this is going on. Because one of the number one rules of the addict is you don't talk. You don't talk about it, and you don't feel. And I learned this from my own family, my own alcoholic family. It's number one rule. You don't talk and you don't feel. So when you've been, you know, in that environment, it really becomes a hurdle to go speak to someone. But I'm telling you, the only reason that I got sober was A, that God's Holy Spirit intervened in my life. And that's got to be the prayer for the person who's an addict. Because until the Holy Spirit moves in, there won't be enough conviction or power to deal with the struggles. Secondly, there were people around me who loved me enough to tell me the truth no matter how irritated I got. And so those two things combined will, I believe, be a help to anybody who's struggling or out of control with a compulsion. And it is happening everywhere, folks. Don't be surprised.
Wow.
It's very relevant. It's the number one or number two, depending on the research you read, reason for hospitalization in this country.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
So don't give up. Reach out and find the help you need.
Okay. If people want to contact you?
301-5500.
All right, 301-5500, Patrick Doyle. Thanks for stopping by again.
Hey, you bet.
Right here on The Dove.
Good
Talk to you next time.
All right.